Hi, and thanks for listening to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I'm your host, David Gottlieb. Witnessing Unbound, Holocaust Representation, and the Origins of Memory is a groundbreaking and thought-provoking new volume from editors Henry Lustiger-Thaler and Habok Noch, published by Wayne State University Press. In a series of essays and interviews, the authors focus on how the nearing disappearance of the last of the primary witnesses to the Holocaust has encouraged new directions in the narratization and understanding of modernity's most unfathomable event. The book interrogates the stylization of the account of the primary witness, and it offers significant new scholarship on the halachic witness, the relationality of being amongst Orthodox prisoners, and the frameworks of Jewish law and praxis through which they confront and endure their imprisonment is among the most significant contributions of this volume. Witnessing Unbound's co-editor, Henry Lustiger-Thaler, is a professor of cultural sociology at Ramapo College of New Jersey. He also contributed to the volume, and he joins me to discuss the book. Professor Lustiger-Thaler, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for the invitation, David.
So can you tell us a little bit about your scholarship to date? Give us some background to your work and how this volume came about.
Sure. Well, I kind of come to Holocaust studies through a delayed interest. I have to say, for many years, I studied human rights abuses, and within the context of globalization, I've also studied social movements that address these issues. And about 15 years ago, I had written a piece on Holocaust representation. And that began another kind of interest, but also turned into a kind of career as well. And I worked on several large museum projects in Europe. And one of those museum projects was the development of the Bergen-Belsen Gedenkstätte, the memorial at Bergen-Belsen. And at that time, I was writing about the Bergen-Belsen DP camp, and I published a few pieces on the religious dimension of DP life. Until then, and I would say, just to paraphrase for a second, the history of displaced persons camps throughout Germany, Austria, Italy was not very well known. And I would say the scholarship itself is probably not more than 15 to 20 years old, at the limit, 20 years old, more likely around 15 years old. And I noticed in my work at Bergen-Belsen, putting together the history of the DP camp, I realized that there was an enormous amount of religious life that was taking place in the DP camp in terms of revitalization of religious life, revitalization of religious Yiddishkeit. And I began to explore that, and I explored it, I would say, globally, given that Bergen-Belsen was in the British military, occupied military zone. I explored it in London, I explored it in New York, I explored it in Germany. And my fascination with what was left out of the rebirth narrative, both in the American occupied zone of Germany and in the British occupied zone of Germany, it fascinated me. So I began to write prodigiously on that topic. And so eventually, with the end of the curation of the museum, which ended some years ago, I began to think more about producing the scholarship specifically on this area. Now, this book, Witnessing Unbound, is a combination of many things. One, it's a combination of there were various conferences that were developed at Bergen-Belsen, and so some of these essays come from those conferences over the past few years, and I invited as well new scholars into the book. The basic ethos behind the book, and I think this occurs, David, every few years as we're entering into the full development, full landscape of Holocaust culture, survivors are leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And what is being left in its wake is representation, and an entire crisis of representation, discussions of representation, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Representation, even to the extent that in these sites of destruction that I worked at in Germany, they're not speaking about representation in the ways that scholars are perhaps speaking about representation, but certainly on the site itself, they avoid representation. They avoid artwork. They avoid photography, unless it's in a very specific bunker, but on the site itself, the site itself should carry that Benjaminian aura of the struggle of life in a death world.
Right.
So they have an intrinsic, because they're practitioners in these sites of destruction, and which have various which have museums. Most of them have museums associated with them, large ones, small. So the book came out of the intersection of the difficulty of representation and at the same time the decline of the survivor population.
Right.
So that is the origin of this book. For me, comes from the meeting of those two phenomena, and those phenomena are absolutely related, because as the survivor leaves the historical stage, it opens the door to further representation,
mm-hmm.
and necessarily so. So this is an effort, this book was an effort to bring together scholars that are looking at experiences that really cut very closely to the core of the original experience of survival.
Mm.
And I asked the authors to try to stay to that. And of course, I chose them because their writing is about that original experience and trying to interpret that original experience over and above the many forms of representation that that itself takes.
Yeah.
So it's a slippery slope. Certainly, but the historical conjuncture is the disappearance of the survivor from the historical stage. And if I just may say something, I have a project right now, and I do quite a bit of exhibition work, and I have a project in Poland, and I'm interviewing, and this is something that we'll talk about momentarily, about the faith-based dimension of my work, but I was looking for both a Polish Catholic and also Roma Sinti, the faith-based Catholic, and to interview them. And I was kind of taken back, first, historically, Poland is not the largest population of Roma Sinti survivors of the Holocaust. They live in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a population in Poland, and I was supposed to interview this gentleman. He was 91 years old, and unfortunately, he was not feeling well that day, and this was about a month and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to rearrange an interview with him in the next couple of months. However, what's striking about this is that he is the last Roma Sinti survivor of Auschwitz.
Wow.
The last living individual.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard that, I thought to myself that in the next few years, we will be hearing here in the United States about the last living survivor.
That's right. That's right.
We're in that kind of space where it is the corporal part of this is developing, that survivors are leaving the historical stage. But at the same time, much of what has been built in terms of memorialization, in terms of many issues, are built on the presence of the survivor. So it just gave the book, it made the book much more urgent from my perspective as well.
Right. You talk about the inherent problem of the narratization of testimony, which even as it brings the reader into the circle of, the immediacy and the naked truth of the experience, at the same time, the narratization creates a stylization around the rawness of the experience that in essence also throws up a veil. And this is something that some of the survivors who are interviewed in the book, or some of the witnesses that are interviewed in the book, talk about. In other words, for example, Nathalie Delbo, who's interviewed in Lawrence Langer's essay, talks about a sort of sensation of having died but gone on living. And Primo Levi talks about a dream that apparently is widely shared amongst survivors, that they a dream that they share, that they rush to tell their stories and are both not believed and actually shunned, which was something that many emerging from the camps actually had. So I guess I'm saying all this to sort of frame the question of what will change in terms of efforts to educate and commemorate this concatenation of events. What will change once the last survivor is gone, and how can we circumvent the problems of narratization that are inherent in the telling of the story?
Yeah, correct. No, it's an excellent question. It's an excellent question, David. I think one of the things that when I interview survivors quite a bit, I have been interviewing survivors for the past 15 years, and both in Europe and in Europe and Canada and in the United States. I think that to describe the experience of what is a limit event, that it's a limit event in the sense of the horror that it encapsulates, mm-hmm. humiliation and the horror that it encapsulates, and of course, finally, the incredible loss. There is, I think where survivors educate us. They educate us in and they're guides to this dark world. The issue really is how do we listen to the darkness of this world? And the larger, more complex question is how do you create a pedagogical program over and above the black letter history of this happened here, this happened here, this happened here.
Right, right.
And over and above the usage within historical work and scholarship of using the survivor testimony, memoir, diaries to be a kind of justification of the actual historical record.
Mm-hmm.
So here you have the experiential justification of the legitimation of the horror of the black letter historical record of Holocaust. So I think that Saul Friedlander understood this problem. And made a case in his last books on the need for new forms of historical writing,
mm-hmm.
and a form of historical writing where indeed survivor subjectivity, either through through testimony, through memoirs, through genre, and of course I'd like to speak a little bit about my own viewpoint on halakhic with
yes.
Which is a genre in and of itself. I would call it testimony is definitely a genre, memoir, diary, and I'm introducing another genre. But I think that one of the things that the complexity of how we will deal with how we listen in the future when the survivor is no longer amongst us is, I don't have the answer. I think it's a major challenge. All I'm seeing is the problems.
Yeah, yeah.
And I see significant ethical, aesthetic, representational, writerly problems because the very image of the survivor and the very voice of the survivor has to a great extent become pre-actualized. So there's a kind of, in the social sciences, one speaks of the Hawthorne effect,
yeah.
that the survivor or the interviewee is looking for cues that they see the listener
mm-hmm.
Almost demanding by the kind of questions. And basically they record what they are asking of the survivor, because the
right.
survivor the survivor compensates in turn, and to a great extent it is also a way to assuage the experience of the retelling by the survivor. So there's I think a complexity of psychological, deep psychological moments and also cultural forms of listening that emerge, and so there is a kind of the survivor interview is certainly very different than the memoir and the diary. Survivor testimony can fall into a kind of listener's construction, and that is. That is a real problem in
yeah.
terms of the legacy that we're left with, and the 55 or 65,000 interviews that the Show History Foundation has gathered, the 7,000 or 8,000 interviews that the Fortunoff Holocaust Testimony Archives has gathered, and the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. There's a variety of different forms of listening to as many as I could. There's a variety of different forms of listenings that come out of these interviews that are that were taken to be the survivor's story.
So that sounds like that's a really interesting observation. And I think when I was introducing you, I neglected to say that you're a professor of cultural sociology at Ramapo College of New Jersey. And that sounds like that observation sounds like something informed by your background as a cultural sociologist. In other words, you're sensitive to the different cultural contexts that are built around interlocutors and listeners, between testimony and archive, and between different forms of speaking and listening. One of the really interesting things, and I want to come back to that, but one of the really interesting things about witnessing in this volume is your essay on halachic witnessing, the Auschwitz memoir of Berish Erlich. So this is the you introduce and then publish in this essay text of an Orthodox survivor of Auschwitz. Can you tell us about this text, how you came to find it, and what it adds to our understanding of the Orthodox survivor, of the halachic witness?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, firstly, let me just say how I came upon it's in fact a diary. Excuse me, it's a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Was written in a diaristic form, i.e. day by day. He wrote it in late 1945 in a displaced persons camp in Germany, the Landsberg displaced persons camp. And he wrote it in, Berish Erlich wrote it in an English class. And the text itself is fascinating just visually. It's three languages. He wrote it in English,
mm-hmm.
in German, and he wrote it in Yiddish. And so each page, and it's written in, which was part of the course at that time, the only kind of stationery around was military stationery.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote it in a kind of logbook for incoming products and outgoing products for military counting.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have rather small pages and three languages described. And the memoir is broken up into two parts. One, his life in the Warsaw Ghetto, which he describes in a very acute and very piercing way,
mm-hmm.
And then his time in Auschwitz. Now, I am also part of, just to go back for one second, part of the work that I was doing in Germany, et cetera, and my own writings, they came to the notice of a group of individuals in Brooklyn who were putting together a proposal for a museum, a Holocaust museum, that examines the world from the Orthodox standpoint. And they asked me if I would be willing to do some work for them, and I have.
Mm-hmm.
And currently I am their chief curator as this museum is being put together, and the museum should be opening up at the end of 2018. And one of the things that our acquisition curator brought in this diary. So this diary actually entered into our archival division. It was a survivor family living in Muncie, New York, which is a very religious community north of New York City. And the diary has been sitting there since 1948, when Berish Erlich came to the United States. So we received the book, or rather the memoir, excuse me, just I guess about a year and a half ago. And so it is the first time that the Auschwitz section of this memoir is published. So it's the first publishing of this particular memoir. I'm working right now on the Warsaw Ghetto part of the memoir, which is as fascinating. But one of the things that this memoir introduced me to was kind of trying to understand the subjective experiences of survivors, Orthodox and faith-based survivors. And although many people speak about the loss of faith, for many religious survivors.
Mm-hmm.
That entire thing has to be nuanced tremendously. Once you get into the ethnography of what is actually happening, so in a way, we have to kind of rely on some of Soloveitchik's work, where he makes a very clear distinction. Rav Soloveitchik makes the distinction between halakhic man and hashkafic man. So essentially, this is a first publication of this particular memoir. But one of the things that fascinated me...
Of the Auschwitz portion of it.
Of the Auschwitz
does that mean that other portions had been previously published?
No. This is the first time that anyone has written on it, and it's the first time that the Auschwitz portion is actually published in its entirety in the English.
I see.
The exact English that it was written in, there's no editing of the English, etc. And there is another part, which is the Warsaw Ghetto part, that's the other part of the memoir, and I'm working on an article on his experiences in the Warsaw Ghetto. But one of the things that fascinated me about this whole approach was in reading some of the other material we have from Baruch Sherlock, because we have his entire collection.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed a lot of issues around what is referred to as shailot and teshuvot,
mm-hmm.
or in Yiddish, shailot and teshuvos, which are question and responsa. And I began to investigate question and responsa exchanges that occurred between rabbinic figures, as well as just Torah-savvy Jews in the camps,
mm-hmm.
and in the ghettos, and looking at the exchanges that occurred between these individuals. And I was looking for any kind of documented writings of the rabbis, if they survived, that would capture this. And my colleague, Esther Farbstein, who has an article as well in this book, Esther Farbstein did a massive, massive data search, and she found most of these Shabbat and Shabbat were incorporated in the prefaces of the rabbis' svarim that they wrote after the war. So
this is really fascinating. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm glad you pointed that out, because she talks about, in other words, their testimony as witnesses was there from the beginning, but always framed in a halakhic context. In other words, it was published as introductory comments in the Sforim that they published, and therefore wasn't available to the general community or the academic community unless someone like her or like you went looking for it.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so there are hundreds of Sforim that have these remarkable prefaces. There are some well-known rabbinic figures who wrote texts on their question and responsa with prisoners, themselves being prisoners. And one of them is Rav Siha Schmeisels from Hungary. And he wrote the Mishnah in the Kadesh Hashem. And this is it's an entire book that deals with the question and responsa. And also Rav Ephraim Oshri, who's very well known, and he wrote a response of the Holocaust. And it's become a kind of staple of the rabbinic perspective on the Holocaust. But as a social scientist, I wanted to understand this exchange that occurred. And these exchanges occurred around not necessarily religious dimensions, although in the ghetto, you had the questions responded that dealt with religious dimensions, but more so dimensions about everyday life. Not so much about, you know, why, but what do I do now?
Mm-hmm.
The why is the hashkafic dimension. The what do I do now is the halakhic. What is my comportment now in the face of this? And in normative times, if these were very, very complicated discussions, then it would go before a judicial court, a bet din. But given that was impossible, the emphasis on the rabbi was really quite remarkable. And so I started to look at this as a genre. And
mm-hmm.
if one looks at testimony as a rather complex exchange between speaker and listener, with all the complexities of the speaking and listening and Trevise has done some beautiful work on this in his book, Witnessing, Witnessing. And so there's a complexity of exchange that occurs, some of which I referred to earlier. And so the testimony is a very specific genre, and it is exactly as it happens. When one does a survivor testimony, and whatever institution it goes to, I mean, a bomb can fall in the middle of the interview and you can't edit it out. I mean,
right.
It's not like documentary film. It's actually a genre of itself, testimony. And, and I can go through the various genres of the memoir, that which really is a memory text looking back. No matter when it's written, if it's written 8 months after, in the case of Berger, or if it's written 8 years later, different perspectives given the time, the distanciation from the actual event. And of course, the diary is a recounting of both mundanity and, in the context of Holocaust, horror, brutality, and death becomes mundanity. And
right.
So I looked at the halakhic witness as a relational kind of event that happens between a prisoner and a rabbi who is a prisoner, and the exchange takes place over several encounters, and oftentimes the rabbi is at his wit's end with the kind of question, an at the limit question of can I ransom my son to get him out of this cage that he lived with 500 other boys, if it means that another boy will die, will be murdered in his place. Those kinds of questions. And if one looks at the nightmare of Auschwitz and the relationship that the capos and guards had with the camp administration, I mean, ransoming was an event that happened often.
And they were trying to fit a halakhic frame around this kind of limit question on a daily basis, correct, even as they were trying to survive.
Correct, absolutely.
Yeah. I wonder if you would talk briefly about your interview with Father Patrick Desbois. This is a really interesting interview with someone who's done astonishing work finding mass graves from mass murders of Jews in Eastern Europe, and who makes some very sensitive and penetrating observations. Among them, the differences in the redaction and collection and archiving of witness and survivor testimony between East and West, and that in some cases he has learned both how this information is kept and how it is concealed, and how witnesses and participants still living in Eastern Europe confront the possibility of witness and testimony. Can you talk briefly about that?
Absolutely, absolutely. So in Patrick's work, there is a dichotomy. One, the peasant bystander. Peasant bystander, he's very clear about in terms of the complexity of the bystander, everything from someone who is involved in requisitioning processes, which taking to clothes and taking whatever jewelry, taking gold out of the teeth, all these elements of the bystander who was requisitioned by the Einsatzgruppen to take whatever can be taken, and then it will be taken out of the village by the Germans. And then, of course, the peasant neighbor who was watching all this and watching the entire Jewish community being marched out, shot, and in mass graves.
Does Father Desbois find that people, that such witnesses and neighbors, have had trouble living with these memories, and do they have trouble speaking about them, or is it just something that happened?
No. It's an event once it's uncovered. It's an event that is central to their lives to a great extent. And Father Desbois covers this in his first book, Holocaust by Bullets. But most definitely, the event is an event of tremendous trauma. If you can imagine these individuals today, they were around 8 or 9 years old when they witnessed mass murders. And that is an event for a child of such tremendous epic proportion that one can believe of the sublimation that occurs. But what Patrick does is very interesting. He comes in as a Catholic priest and he takes confession. So his approach to beginning the dialogue of the interview is confessionary. And he takes confession from them. And as he's taking confession, the story of Holocaust comes out. And they know why he's there. As a matter of fact, many of them, and it just shows you how so little has happened in terms of the mass graves in Eastern Europe. And former satellite states of the Soviet Union, Patrick was often asked, and I think he captures it in the interview, he mentioned in the interview that I asked him the question in the interview, where bystanders who witnessed the murder, the mass murders, ask if he is part of, because he's French, if he's now a French commission, because the last time anyone ever asked him a question was the Soviet commission in 1946. So the kids remember Soviets coming into their villages and asking questions about the mass murders and where the mass graves are and taking testimony, audio testimony on what occurred. And so,
did this information become available after the fall of the Berlin Wall? Was it only then that scholars from East or West could access it?
Yeah, it is still being accessed right now. It's still being accessed right now because we're looking at 2 years of investigation by the Soviets on what happened in these villages. So Patrick's work is finding where these mass graves are and having some sort of level of communication as well with the families,
which involves, at least in the part of witnesses, bystanders, and even participants, it would sound like a measure of absolution or at least forgiveness.
Yeah, I would say certainly in Catholic religious framework, a measure of forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Our time is growing short. I have just two more questions for you.
Yeah.
One is that there's been literature, since the topic of cultural memory became something of considerable academic focus due to the work of Jan Osman and others in the late 80s, considerable attention was turned to memory, to cultural memory and to Holocaust memory. And some scholars have begun to suggest there's almost a surfeit of memory. How do you respond to that observation?
Well, I think that memory studies itself academically is a fairly new phenomenon. And I don't really look at there being a surplus right now, if I caught you correctly, but there's a kind of surplus of memory or a lot of work.
Or a surplus, yeah, yeah.
Because to a certain extent, and I say this also, I'm the series editor for Routledge, for their memory studies collections. It's called Memory Studies Global Constellations. And we have studies from all over the world. And I would have to say that many of the writings that we're getting are from not necessarily historians, although we have some historians, but most of them are from political scientists, from anthropologists, from historical sociologists who work somewhat differently than historians, and some from historians. But I would say that historians are not the largest group that I have in my series right now. So I think that the whole discussion of memory is not so much as a field in of itself, but how the paradigm of looking at the past through the present is a element that many, many disciplines are beginning to see as a valuable way of looking at their own disciplinary concerns, understand the vestiges of the past in the present in terms of discourse and in terms of practice. So from that standpoint, I think we're just at the very beginning of the exploration of a kind of a memory analytics on every level, the aesthetic level, the literary level, the level of representation taking place in museums at sites of destruction, which is particularly problematic. It's not, you know, art at Yad Vashem is one thing. Art at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum outside is another thing. But art at a site of destruction is complex.
Right. My final question is really kind of a personal one. I think you note in the introduction that you are the son of a Holocaust survivor. Would you mind talking a little bit about that and about how that has informed your work?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I have to say that I think there are many different relationships that one has to having a parent, or in my case, my mother was a Polish survivor of the Holocaust, went through multiple camps, and my father. Paul Shapiro's chapter on the Soviet experience, the Soviet Jewish experience, that would be my father's experience. He went deeply into the Soviet Union for those 4 years. What it does is it makes me more sensitive to how I am listening. And I think that that can take many, many different forms. But as a scholar, I'm constantly analyzing my own techniques of listening when I'm interviewing and when I'm writing. It has sensitized me to voice.
Well, I really want to thank you for joining me today to talk about this very compelling book, which is a really welcome addition to multiple fields having to do with memory and Holocaust studies at a time, as you have noted, when the last of the witnesses and those who experienced the horror of the camps are still among us. I've been talking today with Henry Lustiger-Thaler, professor of cultural sociology at Ramapo College of New Jersey, and he is the co-editor with Habo Knoch of Witnessing Unbound, Holocaust Representations and the Origins of Memory, published in 2017 by Wayne State University Press. Professor Lustiger-Thaler, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you so much, David.